there's a lot of people here this evening. Reminds me of a talk I gave over in Singapore some years ago. One person came an hour early to get a seat, but she had to go to the toilet. When she went outside, she couldn't come in again. She was really upset. So the next time she came to a talk, I told her to bring one of those things they have in the hospital. Okay, let's get people coming in, going out. Hope there's no one from the council here tonight. We've probably got too many people. Noise abatement. I don't have to worry about noise abatement. Outside is good. You can still hear outside, and outside you've got natural aircon. So you can still come in the fronts and the sides over there if you wish to. There's always a few places somewhere. Okay. So as many of you know, that for this Friday night talks, I'm very open to getting suggestions. I've already got enough suggestions for the next month, so please no more suggestions for the talk. But one of the people who've looked after our Buddhist Society for a long time, she used to be the editor of our newsletter, she said that her children especially were so afraid of climate change. You know, the fear was something which was taking away their happiness, the ability to enjoy their life. Can I please, please, please say something about the Buddhist attitude to climate change? And before you actually go out and just say, oh no, I don't want to hear this again, or those others say, yes, at last, Ajahn Brahm is talking about something to do with the environment. This is a Buddhist attitude towards these things, so it's not going to be what you've heard before. It's just going to give another angle to this problem which people have in life about worrying what to do with, you know, the future, especially with something like climate change. And what's the Buddhist attitude towards this? One thing which, I'm not an environmentalist, I haven't read up on this, I'm not an expert by any means, but one of the things which a Buddhist monk can add to this is just a different perspective. And so in this talk, I'm just going to throw out a few more things which you may not have heard before, a few other different attitudes which could bring solutions, and also just to deal with the underlying fear which people have. But first of all, it was one of my friends, colleagues, Ajahn Sujata. You know, he was looking through some of the ancient texts, and he came across this metaphor. It's in one of the Jataka tales about climate change. And you know, it's amazing to see that something which is applicable to our modern world was, you know, almost foreseen by, you know, someone like the Buddha 2,500 years ago. And also the metaphor is very apt for today's world. And, you know, take your mind back 2,500 years ago, and the metaphor was of a group of sailors. And they were actually carpenters. They were running away because they hadn't paid their bills, and, you know, just like today. And sometimes, you know, that sometimes people think that we live in a modern age, but it's great that when you study sort of some of the texts of Buddhism 2,500 years ago in India, it's amazing, it's quite surprising how similar, you know, cultures are in a different part of the world and such 25 centuries ago. And for example, one of the little anecdotes which I tell people was that there was one monk who was wandering for alms round, you know, which is what monks do, with their bowl, just for food, not for money. If any of you see some of those scallywag monks or scam monks in the city, you know, they are not monks, nothing to do with Buddhism at all. Don't give them any money. Just take photographs of them and tell them, you know, that they're going to be in big trouble. Sometimes they say, oh, we can't speak English. They can speak enough English to ask you for money. So be careful, they're nothing to do with Buddhism. But anyway, this guy was doing the proper things just for some food, and he walked behind the law courts, where he saw the judges and other people exchanging big wads of money. And that was 2,500 years ago. Don't think that corruption is something new. It's part of our life, wherever we go, in whatever country, whatever time. You know, it's somehow or other. But this particular story was of some sailors who were running away because they'd done some bad karma, and they'd got shipwrecked, and they managed to find their way to this island where there was this one hermit on the island who'd been shipwrecked a long time ago. And he welcomed all these new guys onto his island. You're not like, you know, some other politicians who don't welcome anyone onto this island called Australia. Welcome this. But he said, look, now this island, I've been living here for a long time. I'm very healthy, very happy here. And they used a metaphor of like spirits who were looking after this island. He said, when I first landed here, the spirits welcomed me. And they said, there's enough here for everybody, but you have to have these rules. And the rules were, you know, you'd only eat what you needed. And anything which is left over, including your own urine and excrement, please just bury it in a hole so it's not healthy. Please do not despoil the beauty of this little island. And he said, I've been living here for years, keeping these rules, and I'm healthy, happy, there's plenty to eat, plenty to drink, and I live a wonderful life without any health problems or any other problems at all. If you do the same, you'll be welcome. And so for the first few weeks, or a few months, these new arrivals, they did what was asked of them, you know, always being very careful. But after a while, they said, we're getting bored. Why don't we have a party? And so that some of them started getting some fruit from the trees and fermenting it. Others made musical instruments. And when they were ready, they had this big party on the island. They all got drunk. And they all made a big mess, and it really started to upset the spirits who lived on this island. And that was only the start. They asked the spirits told this guy who was there first, tell these people not to do that. You know, they're making a mess of this paradise of an island. But they wouldn't listen. They held party after party. So the spirit told this fellow, he said, look, please build a boat. Build a boat quickly and go out to sea. And he respected these spirits of the island. He built that boat. And he told all the other people, I don't know why I'm building the boat, why I have to go out to sea, but you better come with me. He said, no, why? This is a beautiful island. We're having fun. So he went out alone. And the next day, the big tsunami came and washed over that whole island to kill all those people who despoiled the island and to wash it clean. And that was actually a story of a tsunami in the time of the Buddha. And they said it was just like calls because people did not respect the land and the other spirits who lived on that land and looked after it. It was an interesting metaphor from 2,500 years ago in the Jataka tales. And so, you know, those are the sorts of metaphors which, you know, as a Buddhist monk, we try and, you know, look after. We care for the land in which we live. One of the reasons why is because we're going to be living on there for a long time. One of the advantages of being a Buddhist, talking about climate control or climate change, is that some of our politicians are now so old, they are not going to be here, you know, when the SHIT hits the fan and the climate really starts to go wrong. You know what I mean. They're already so old. That's why it's the young people who are really concerned about this. However, if you're a real Buddhist and you believe in something like reincarnation, Mr. Tony Abbott is going to come back here. And everybody else, and Mr. George Bush, Obama, everybody else is doing absolutely nothing or not doing enough. They're going to have to live by the consequences. And so straight away, when you have a spirituality which it understands that life doesn't finish at death, then there's a much more responsibility to looking after, you know, the things which we have right now. If you're only renting a house, you don't look after it as much as if you own the house and you're going to be in it for a long, long, long time. So that's one of the reasons why some of the Buddhist attitudes towards climate change is actually to go at some underlying causes why people aren't concerned enough. And the reason is because we don't see a long term, because we don't think we have a long term. One of the biggest problems is something I said a couple of talks ago, the materialistic attitude which we have, and I don't mean to things, I mean to the body and mind, thinking we're just this mind is part of the brain, and so when the brain dies and you're gone, finished, kaput, and there's no consequences for you, that has had huge consequences for things like climate change. You know, for the lack of continuity, the short-term view of just one life. Just like sometimes we blame politics, that, you know, they just look for the next election. And that's as far as they look in their planning. And the same with human beings. We just look for the end of this life and we don't look beyond, which is one of the reasons why that long-term view means we're not that concerned about sustainability, either of our own life, you know, a few, many lifetimes, through the spirituality, through the learning, through the growing, in all these qualities like kindness and understanding and wisdom and softness, all those qualities we tend not to really worry about. Instead, just live, drink, be merry today, and to hell with tomorrow. And I'm talking about live, drink, have fun in this life, and who cares afterwards? Now, of course, you know, there's other talks which I've given. There's lots of evidence that, you know, the brain is not the mind. When the brain dies, the mind carries on. You should know that by now, but that's another talk. I love talking about that, but maybe not this evening. But that is one of the reasons I say why there is not enough concern. And we all know that if there was concern, you know, about things like climate change, if there was concern about, like, violence in Northbridge, that's our entertainment district, if we were concerned about corruption, we can do it. As long as we admit there's a problem, we accept there's a problem which needs fixing, we will be able to do it. Some years ago, I was privileged to go to this high-profile conference on the Gold Coast. Not the Gold Coast, it was sort of the Great Barrier Reef, Hayman Island, which was like a resort. So when I got the invitations, I'd never been there before, I asked people, what is this place? And some of the people, some of the very wealthy people who come here says, even I have not been able to go there. That's really exclusive. So, you know, as a Buddhist monk who lives very simply, I only go to exclusive places. So I went there, and it was a leadership conference with Kevin Rudd, Wayne Swan, Julia Gillard, Mrs. Bly from Queensland, Brumby from Victoria, all these high-profile people there. And it was a really amazing conference because with those sorts of people there, you don't have JoJo's giving talks. These are, you know, the best in their field. I remember one of the panels, which I was, you know, well, not presenting, but listening to, was a panel on climate change. They had some really high-profile experts. But instead of having this normal panel discussion, they set the parameters. They said, this is a scenario I want you all to sort of take on board. They said, an iceberg, or a big part of the ice shelf in Greenland has just fallen off, has created a tsunami, which has devastated the port of New York City. And that is actually quite a reasonable scenario. That can happen. Unlikely, but it's possible. And they said, there was so much destruction that the world governments have decided they have to do something. And in 1 year, they managed to take the carbon dioxide emissions down to zero. They've done that. Now, work backwards. How did that happen? How did we get, not the thing from here to zero? We are at zero. Now, how did that happen? Work backwards. It was a wonderful little way of solving problems. Instead of, I'm in this big problem, how do I get out of this? Imagine you have got out of it. How did you do it? It actually works backwards and rather than working forward. And it's a very good way of finding solutions. And all these incredibly wise and informed scientists were saying, yeah, this is how it happened. What they were saying, it is possible, it always will be possible. At any time, it's just the political will to do that, the wanting to do it. As I remember, Ajahn, years and years ago, I'm quoting Ajahn Sujat, who's be back in a couple of weeks giving the talk here on a Friday night. You know, he was in a conference with me, and he said, the main problem of climate control and many other problems in our life is desire. And that's also the solution, the desire. The desire to have, to possess, to control, that's caused a problem in the first place. But the desire to fix it can solve it. So we just have to put our desire in a more positive way, to use, you know, our aspirations, our energies and efforts. And of course, it can be done. So the solutions are there. And this was a very high-profile conference. But why, my main thing is, why aren't those solutions being implemented? And again, one of the reasons, obviously, is, you know, we don't see the danger. One of the reasons we don't see the danger is because we are a very materialistic world rather than a spiritual world. Some weeks ago, I think in December last year, somebody asked me a question which was totally out of left field. And I gave a wrong answer. And I apologize for that, because they said, and I was thinking as a scientist, they say, has the sun got consciousness? I said, of course not, it hasn't got consciousness. You know, a sun, you know, it's just this big nuclear reactor, fusion reactor of, you know, hydrogen going to helium. Of course, it's just a big, big chemical nuclear reaction, that's all it is. But then I thought again, you know, the whole idea of the nature of consciousness needs to be changed. Now, is the sun conscious? Now, is the earth conscious? And sometimes I realize, I apologize, whoever asked that question, you were smarter than me. And now I say, in one sense, you can say these things have a consciousness, have a life, have a spirit, if you like, just like many ancient cultures had. And certainly in some Buddhist texts, you even see that there. I just rejected that, thinking that's just something which was way past its use by date. We're a modern people now. I was trained in theoretical physics. How can you say these things just have a consciousness, have a spirit, have a meaning? Maybe they do. I was just mentioning, I don't know when I said this, or my talk on loving kindness I gave somewhere or other, seeing the effect of loving kindness on machines. You know, just that funny story, which is absolutely true. I mentioned it in my latest book, you know, The Good, Bad, Who Knows. One of the Anagarikas who spent a year with me at Bodhinyana Monastery. After that, he went to Germany to carry on with his education. He was a young man. The first time he was at this university in, I think, Hamburg somewhere, he passed the ATM machine. It's the ATM story. It's a brilliant story. He passed an ATM machine the first day on campus, and the ATM machine gurgled at him. It made a sound. He called it a gurgle. And he took that to mean the ATM had a consciousness and was welcoming him onto campus. And that's how he believed, okay? You may think that's a crazy guy. But that meant every time he passed his ATM, you know, he said good day to it, you know, guten Morgen, you know, hope you have a wonderful day, whatever it was. He gave that ATM respect and loving kindness. And I checked the story with him. I think I went to Frankfurt a couple of years ago. He came to my talk. I said, look, I want to write this in the book. Please be honest with me. Did this happen? And he said, absolutely, Ajahn Brahm. I respect you. I'm a Buddhist. I'm not going to lie to you. I don't lie to anybody, but especially not to you. Because he said, you know what people are like. And he said he was having lunch, you know, maybe a few feet from the ATM on a bench on the campus. No one was around. And he heard the gurgle again. And he turned around, and a 20 euro note came out of the ATM machine. It just came out. And he could not believe it. No one had been around for 10 or 15 minutes. No one had pressed any buttons. And he just couldn't believe it. He went up there, took it out, and he waved it up. Does this belong to anybody? Of course, no one claimed it because it wasn't theirs. It was his. The ATM machine was repaying his kindness. That is actually a true story. Now, how can that happen? Now, don't go to the ATM machines tonight and say, nice ATM machines, nice, I really love you. May you never run out of electricity. May no one rob you or blow you up. Come on, cough up. That doesn't work. But, you know, can a machine have some sort of consciousness? Can it have kindness? Maybe you just need to expand your mind a bit, and maybe it does. And so this whole idea of other things, you know, having... I actually practiced that a few times. My cement mixer, which I have for years and years, sometimes no one else can make it work. So pulling the string, it never works. So get out of the way. I'd actually stroke. Come on. And I pull it, first time, it would always work. I could always do that. So sometimes, you've probably had those experiences as well. And if like a machine, like a cement mixer, you know, can respond to your kindness, planet Earth, that whole idea of that Gaia hypothesis, which I admit I poo-pooed for many years, maybe there is something to it. Maybe if we do consider, you know, this land in which we live, we're not as an inanimate thing, but something which is got some sort of consciousness. May we take better care of it in the same way we look at ourselves. There's not just a brain, not just some mechanism which is totally controlled by genes and other biochemistry, which I really reject these days. As a scientist, that is just so much rubbish. There's more to it than that. The human body responds. That's why, you know, I've been there, miracle cures, cancers just disappearing amazingly. Why? No one can explain that. They call it anomalies in science, but it happens. Sometimes it's more to it than just you know, the science, which people can actually see in petri dishes, you know, in the laboratory. Sometimes it's much more than that. So look at, when we change the attitude, you know, from just a materialistic, just what you can learn in science, which is very reductionist. Reductionist means you just take a few principles and you think if you know the core principles, you can expand that to so much different levels of degree that those same rules will always apply. And they don't apply. Some of the laws of science, they only apply at certain levels. Now, they're very microscopic, they don't apply at macroscopic levels. And even for those of you who are hard scientists, one of those is quantum physics does not apply in the big levels of universes. Now, that's where the general theory of relativity applies. And scientists for years are trying to be able to find why at one level this particular famous law of physics applies and other levels it doesn't. Maybe there's something fundamental there. Laws of scale. So maybe there may be something to do with, you know, this universe even being a conscious being. Just like some of the indigenous tribes would always try and impress upon us. And sometimes you see that. And sometimes we think we're just so advanced that is just ideas which are well past their use by date. And maybe that's one of our problems. We've forgotten our cultures of the past. And if we could try and reinvigorate those cultures, maybe that might be one of the solutions to stopping or reversing climate change. But it's true, I see miracle cures with people's bodies. And I've been there when it's happened. Miracle cures for planet Earth. Nothing is ever lost with the right attitude. So, my job is to take away this hard materialistic view about life, about your own body and mind, about just our universe, and especially this earth, to get some more sensitivity there. And what that really means, that will actually change one's attitudes and even change one's lifestyle. Just change the way you look at things. When you change perceptions, that is when actions start to change. Our job is just to change those perceptions. The perception you have to yourself, as I often say, to forgive yourself and don't be so fault-finding to yourself. Your perception to your partner or to being single, what I talked about last week. It's not about being single or having a partner, being old, being young. It's your perception, you know, to that state of affairs. That is so much important, changing perceptions. And that's my job here. So we change perceptions because you can blame the politicians, but you know, we elect the politicians. Now, and it's because the majority of people elect politicians who don't care about climate change, don't care about basic sort of health, spirituality, looking after one another. Those come about because we don't care about such things. So we're trying to get that back again. One solution, which is radical, but why not? That's my job, to put out these radical solutions. I put this out before here. I put this out recently in a lecture on human rights at Curtin University. On, let's make democracy more democratic. We think we have a democracy here in Australia and many other countries as well. I don't think it's fair. Why is it that someone who is, say, 80 years of age has the same vote as someone who is 20 years of age? My solution will be people from 18 to 30 years of age, they have a full vote. From 30 to 40, you have 80% vote. 40 to 50, 60%. 60 to 70, 40%. 70 to 80, 20%. When you're over 80, you don't have a vote. You know why? Because when you're 80, you're at the end of your life. You have got no stake in the decisions being made. In the same way that, you know, those of you who know about companies and stocks and shares, the more shares you have, the more votes you have. And that's logical. That makes sense. The more you have to lose or gain, the more votes you should have. Someone who's 18 have got their whole life in front of them. And the decisions made are going to affect them much more than they're going to affect an 80-year-old. So my solution to change democracy is giving more votes to the young who've got more shares in this life than people like me who's getting old. Especially those, you know, getting 80 years of age. You're leaving here. You've got no real investment in this life anymore. It's out of here. Bye. I'm leaving. Now, that would change a lot. Of just it's radical, but why not? Try something radical. Number one, we'd have many amazing sort of politicians elected. Now, if the young had more influence instead of these old guys running the country. You know, years and years ago, this place here, I sort of bit the bullet. I don't know if he's here this evening, Sol. No, we're going to have an AGM in a couple of months' time where we elect the committee of this place. And you know, we have a president, a secretary, a vice president and stuff. And one year, we had this young guy, only 23 years of age, I think he was, and I elected him, made sure, it's not really democracy, I did sort of, you know, do a bit of influential lobbying, that's what it was called. Lobbying from the boss. And so he became our president. And you know, this young guy, he was the guy, more than anybody else, who made sure we got online. You know, realizing, as I would never understand, the future of communication was not actually sitting here, but sitting at home and watching this on your computer. And so we wasted a lot of money putting everything online, which is why he called it the bleeding edge of technology. Not the leading edge, the bleeding edge, because we wasted a lot of money, because we were just innovating all the time. But because of him, because he was young, had ideas, you know, and we gave him, off you go, just do it. He innovated. How on earth can we have innovation when most of the people in cabinets throughout our world are at least 50, using more than that? They haven't got the the view and the commitment to the future, which no young people have. So why not try something like that? Revolutionary, but why not? And then what happens is it skews the politics to those people who have more investments in this thing we call life. And so they'll look at things in a different way. And sometimes that might affect even things like climate change. And how does it affect the climate change? Look, quite frankly, you know, we have too many kids. Well, we should have the government sponsoring more monks and more nuns. It's obvious, because when we lessen the population, we need less water, we need less electricity, we don't need big power stations all over the world, we don't need so many cars and bigger roads which are just consuming so much energy for the place. And so we have just, you know, more monks and nuns, and the government gives a subsidy for every monk and every nun, because we don't produce kids. You know, we are environmentally gold standard. That's what I like to do. And if you do want somebody, you know, to spend your life, get a dog, get a cat. Now, dogs never speak back to you. Now, cats never borrow the car and smash it. And they give you lots of emotional happiness back. But it's one of the big problems. And obviously the other big problem which we have in our modern world, and I keep on mentioning this, one of the things which Buddhism can really talk about is learning how to live simply. You go to visit Bodhinyana Monastery or Dhammasara Nuns Monastery and see how the nuns and the monks actually live. You know, we've got small little places where we live. And many years ago, just a group of women, you know, they have an afternoon club. You know, they were just coming just to see something different, something weird. And we qualify as different and weird, you know, Buddhist monks. And so they came along. We took them around. I remember taking them around. I was living in a hut that time before I went into my cave. And I showed them inside my hut. This is where I live. This is a monk's hut. Now, we've got about 20 of those huts at Bodhinyana. And they looked around. And, you know, they couldn't believe how small it was. And one of them said this to me, and I'll never forget it. He said, "I wish my house was this small. Then I could get my weekly housework done in half an hour." Now, how much housework do you have when you go home? And how much work do you have in your garden and around the place in which you live? It's a workplace where people live these days. It's not a home anymore, because it's too damn big. Now, downsize. Now, that's something which anyone here is in planning or in government. Can't we have better planning regulations so that small houses are permitted? Now, we have a hard time when we take plans for a monk's hut to the shrine. So you can't do this. You know, where's the toilet? Where's the shower? Where's the kitchen? So we don't have a kitchen. We go to toilet in the bush. You know, we dig a hole, and that's the most environmentally best way to dispose of things. And then you plant a tree on when it's full. You don't have to have all these pipes and all this other stuff which goes wrong. And we have a shared kitchen, that's all we need. You know, about 30 people? We have one small kitchen, that's all we need. Instead of you have a kitchen here and a kitchen in this house and a kitchen in everybody else's house, why not have just one kitchen in the middle of your street? And with a big dining room, and everyone goes and eats together. There'll be a community. You know, and people actually living and getting to know one another, because you have to. And they have these small little houses, you know, where you can just be. You don't need a house for every member of your family. And how many of you just, you know, wonder what your son is doing in his room all the time? Just, you know, have no doors. Take the doors off. Even take the walls down so you can actually see what each other's doing. wouldn't that give the idea of a family again? So you go to the shy for this, or who cares, that goes down. So time flies when I give it to you. Sorry. But you're not allowed to have small houses. There's just so many regulations. Why is that? It's just profits again. So if we can have like small places to live, more communal accommodation, more communal stuff, number one, we'll have a much better social life. We meet with each other. There won't be so many lonely people and depressed people. And we're also, you know, we grow up with lots of other people. So, you know, our social skills are far, far better. If you grow up in your own room, you know, you don't know how to talk to people. You know, boys don't know how to talk to girls. Girls are afraid of boys, and they end up just, you know, just not marrying, not doing anything together, and just being lonely because they haven't developed the social skills of approaching one another. And so we've had like a small place, or people living closer together, instead of this big being apart from one another in a big house. Number one, how many resources will that save? And with the small buildings and people living closer together, all the other infrastructure of railways and buses and stuff like that, we won't need our cars anymore because we won't have to travel so far. That's my problem. You know, just we live in the forest. It'd be great if there was a train line came to the forest and then I could actually get on the train and just come here instead of having to come in the car every week. But you just can't do that. I know people say, why don't you get a bicycle and jump on? Have you seen that hill going up to Bunyan? That would kill me. I'd be dead. But, you know, we try and do the best we can. And that's why living simply is the way to go. Apparently some people are visiting Bodhinyana in a week or two's time. There's a bus going somewhere. At first I've heard about it. I live there, but I don't know what's going on. You know, that's one of the nice things. You don't have to know everything. Sometimes people want to know so much and they can't remember anything. They worry so much and they just get themselves all stuffed up. Me, I only know what I need to know, which is not that much. That means my mind is very peaceful. So for those of you who know, or my sort of age, or saw that amazing wise philosophy philosophy series was on TV years ago called Hogan's Heroes. Remember him? Sergeant Schultz, he's my icon with management. Remember Sergeant Schultz in this prisoner of war camp in Germany? I see nothing, I see nothing. It's a much better way to live as a manager. But anyway, so they're coming up to our monastery in a few days. You know, in a nice little bus to have a look around. And it's great they can actually see that it is possible to live simply. And you have much more fun. You don't need... I was joking to them. Just say, you know, you can bring your own razors if you like, or we can shave your hair when you get there. Because, and isn't it wonderful having no hair? You don't have to worry so much about, you know, having to go to the hairdressers and all that fuel you waste, you know, goes up into the environment and cutting your hair. Just actually, just shave it off. It's so much easier. Number one, you are sexier. That's what people say. I don't believe it. Just like Bruce Willis. And it means you don't have a bad hair day. You don't have to worry about dyeing your hair when you get old. You know, I don't dye my hair, you know, because it's great. So whatever it is, anything you can do to keep things simple, why not? You have much more fun. Much more time. Which is the most important thing with our modern world. We've just hardly got any time left at all for each other. The reason is, of course, we're doing too much. We've got too much to do. So keep things simple and you can retire early. I retired at 23. Now that's an important part of actually looking after our planet. Learning how to live simply. And learning actually to care so we don't leave such a footprint in whatever we do. So those are some of the things about climate change. But one of the biggest things which this lady was saying, her kids are so afraid of what might happen. That, you know, that's why that as a mother, she wants to make sure that her kids can live a beautiful life. now to enjoy what she enjoyed, and maybe just enjoy more than she enjoyed without any problems. But one of the biggest problems is fear itself. Because, as I said to a person earlier, it's such a common problem for our modern world. We look into the future always with a negative mind, always thinking of what might go wrong, rather than changing the attitude around and looking into the future and thinking what might go right. And it's amazing when you start to think of what might go right, you have much better solutions. Ideas come up. When you have negativity, the mind is not creative at all. It gets depressed, it loses energy, motivation, it loses its spark. It's one of the reasons why that particular method of solving solutions, which I was learnt in Hayman Island, you've got the solution. How did you get it? Not here I am with the problem, how am I going to solve the problem? You don't think, how am I going to solve the problem? You think, how did I arrive at the solution? It's a totally different ball game. And it's amazing what happens. That's a positive mind. Fear is, I've got a problem, how am I going to solve this? The positive mind is, there's a solution. Where did it come from? You can see it's a totally different way of looking at life. And you can apply that to so many other parts of your life. You've got cancer, you've just got divorced, you've lost your job or whatever. Don't get depressed. I've lost my job. How am I going to find another one? Imagine you've got a job. How did I get that? Then you find other solutions in life. And that's a great way of trying to, you know, have this positive mind so we don't get lost in fear. Fear is what cripples us. Just like some polio used to cripple children in the old days. It cripples our mind. It cripples our creativity. It cripples our just ability just to tell stupid jokes, like I told last week. You know, most people say, how can you tell naughty jokes like that? Aren't you afraid? I say, no, I'm not afraid of anything. Now, I always have such a positive mind. No matter what happens, it's always good. That's why climate change. If the sea level rises, then Bodhinyana Monastery will be by the beach. They're up in the hills. That's what my positive mind state. Now, if you have that positive mind, you've got energy, creativity, whatever. Okay, it's a bit of a joke. Don't get negative. Say, what about all the people down below who get bloody, got no place to stay and stuff like that? That's negativity sometimes. Okay, fair enough. It's a problem, but you can always start finding solutions when you have this just positive, playful mind. Fear stops you being playful. Fear just keeps you trapped, you know, in anxiety, which is one of the reasons why, you know, to have creativity, to have ideas, to have solutions come up, you have to put aside all your fear. And that is what's stopping you finding solutions. It's what making the problems worse. So playfulness is one of the antidotes to fear. That's why you know that people keep on saying that they keep on saying that just giving public talks is the most frightening thing in the world. I give so many public talks, you wouldn't believe how many public talks I give every year. Some are on TV, some are live, and do you think I'm afraid when I give public talks? Do I look like I'm nervous when I give? I'm not nervous because I'm playful. If you're playful, that's the antidote to fear. And being playful means you get new ideas. You can create things. You can be inspired by playfulness. That's why some of the things I say here, you know, just where did that one come from? I never thought that out. So being playful with the environmental problems. Don't be so damn serious. But I've got to be serious. The world's going to end. Yes, I know, but be playful. And then it's likely to last much longer. I think I may have told this last week. I keep forgetting all these stories, but I keep telling so many people. One of these guys, really ill, with cancer and doesn't know what else, really old, he was in the hospice at Murdoch. And I went to see him, and he said, it's amazing, you know, being terminally ill. Because now I can eat whatever I like. I can have the greasiest foods, as much sugar as I want in my tea. I'm going to die anyway, so what the hell? So he's having all this greasy food, all this really unhealthy stuff, because he was terminal. And he had such a good time, he got better. And he walked out of that hospice. He went back there later on to die, of course, but just being able to eat what he wanted, not sugar, salt, whatever, he started to get better. You all know why, don't you? Because he's enjoying himself, he's having fun. And that was actually giving him this mental energy, which was, you know, stopping the cancer, whatever else was going on inside his body. Can you see just how when we get really afraid, that kills us? We have playfulness, a bit of joy, a bit of fun, even with the environment. Then we might find amazing solutions. And that is actually very important. Somebody was telling me, I told this story over in Penang. I read in a newspaper, I like to read quirky stuff in the newspapers, not the sort of the ordinary stuff. For those of you who travel, and I travel a lot on aircraft, you know, there is the safety demonstration. You know, please put your seatbelt on, the life jackets are under the seat. You know, if cabin pressure drops, these things will come on. Help yourself first before the children. You know, I've seen that so many times. And so this one airline, I can't say who it was, they decided that no one was ever listening to this. You know, they just, come on, let's get this over with so we can get the food trays out. They decided to actually dance it. So all these flight attendants were dancing around. The life jacket is under the seat. Da 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 da. Now I can't dance, I can't sing, so I do apologize for even trying. And you know, because they were playing around and making it fun, everybody was paying attention. And they actually learned where the life jackets were for the first time. And they all clapped afterwards. And I thought, yes, that is how you should make announcements. Hugh. You can try for next week. But you can understand when it's playful, you innovate, people pay attention, it works. So look, please, whoever asked that question, please tell your kids to be more playful, not be so much afraid. The playfulness, not only are you enjoying this life while it's still here, but also you're extending it, like that gentleman in the hospice in Murdoch. You're getting ideas, innovating, seeing different ways of looking at things when you're playful. I was told that in the Cavendish Laboratory in Cambridge, where I was doing physics. They said, play with all these machines, because that's where you find these great discoveries. Don't think in a straight line. So being playful with regard to climate change, you'll find solutions. Solutions are there. And also, learn how to think backwards. Solution is there. Let's find out why. But also, for goodness sake, can we just get some younger people in power? People who've got more investment in this life? And at very least, have a bit more spirituality and less materialism. And I don't mean things. I mean this materialistic philosophy of the brain is the be-all and end-all of this thing we call a human being. Have a spirituality more than the brain. Consciousness. The thing which drives you. Your emotions. How can you call love something coming from a brain? So, if you've got a kid, and they come up to you as soon as you go home and give you a big hug. Is that just some gene in the body which has evolved over many sort of lifetimes just to protect them and survival of the fittest? Come on, I don't think any neuroscientist would ever sort of believe that if that was their kid. Please be honest to life, not just honest to theories. And then when we have that as a basis for our worldview, I think it would be very easy to care for this earth. Just as you care for ATMs. And the earth will give you. So that's just a few interesting, maybe out of left field, what you haven't heard before, Buddhist ideas on climate control. Not the whole story at all. There's plenty more, but it gives you some insight into how we can solve one of these problems and how we can also solve many other problems in our world. Thank you for listening. Very good. Okay, he knows. When you do three sadhus, now many of you have taught you how to do this before. Whatever you do in life, just give it some energy. Don't just sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu means it's good. You know, it's like clapping. It's a Buddhist way of saying, yes, well done. So all together now, follow me. Sadhu. 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 Now, isn't that better for your depression? Of course it is. This is like, give it energy in life. Okay, now I've probably got some really bad comments from real environmentalists. I'm not a real environmentalist, I'm just a monk, so let's see what I've got to put up with now. Very good. You're not going to you didn't dance when you came over.
It's not the time to dance.
Okay. Not at your age. Okay, from Thailand. Is it possible that animals of low birth can understand us? When I was young, there was a venomous wasp nest in our house. But we didn't want to kill them, so Mum just took out some incense and talked to them, telling them to go away. Soon they left. Please comment. Absolutely. I've done that with many animals, but one in particular, one of the huts we built in our monastery down at Serpentine was an A-frame hut. I built that. There was a big ant nest right next to it. And so I talked to those ants, said, look, you know, I'm not going to disturb your home, so please don't disturb ours. And I was really careful, even though it took much more time, to make sure I never put the pieces of wood, you know, on their nest or never did anything to them at all. Built that hut, and the ants never, ever came into that hut. I was living there for the first couple of years. After 3 or 4 years, someone drove over that nest with a tractor. And then they started coming in. And it was just so obvious to me. You look after these, you know, ants are very intelligent. You know, one of our Anagarikas, he's the 10 preceptors, he gave them a test. You know the ants' nest they have in Australia? He put a sugar cube on top of the nest. Now that's food, and the ants like that. He wondered, what are they going to do with this sugar cube? Now are they going to sort of tear it apart so they can get it into their nest? You know what they did, the solution? Great engineers, ants, they excavated from underneath. And day by day, this sugar cube got lowered, 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 lowered. Until when it was just underneath, they covered it up. You know, exactly the same way the Viet Cong, when they captured American tanks while they put them underground, they did it the same way, without big materials at all. That was an incredible, intelligent solution to a problem these ants had never faced, you know, ever in their evolution. They knew what to do. So these animals are highly intelligent. And you maybe have your own stories about that, but yes, you know, you can actually talk to these beings. Like you can talk to an ATM. From Singapore. Hi Ajahn, what's your advice for countries like Europe, Japan, China and Singapore where the percentage of old people is growing and there are worries there's not enough young people to support them? What do you mean supporting them? If people can live quite simple lives, they don't need much support. Of course, one of the reasons that they think they need support is because we live in separate homes. Village in Thailand, where I grew up in as a monk, it was great to see those houses had about 15 or 20 people in them at all times. Great grandparents, uncles, aunts, brothers and sisters and little children, the whole range of ages just in one house. And it worked. In the rice season when they had to plant and harvest, all the able people, maybe the young grandparents and parents and brothers and sisters, they'd be all out in the fields. Everybody was needed. And the very old and the very young would stay at home. The very old would look after the very young, or sometimes the very young looking after the very old. Everyone had a place. And you all know just how wonderful it is when you're really young, having your grandparents around. Grandparents are just, you love each other to bits. You know, the grandparents spoil you. You know, my grandma, whenever you wanted chips, come to my house, I'll give you any time of the day. I don't care if it's healthy or not healthy. If you want chips, you have chips. I love my grandma for that. And you have similar stories. Grandparents are really cool. Because mothers, they tell you what to eat and what to do and all sorts of stuff. But, you know, grandparents, no, they spoil you. That's their job. And that's the same with the kids' love. So when you have everybody together, it's incredible warmth. And one of the memories, I can see it now. First year I was in Thailand. It was 1974, I think. You're out that time. Going into the village in the evening to do a ceremony. No electricity in a remote village. But seeing every house, there was a platform which was raised above the ground. The water buffalo were underneath. The people at the top. Sri Lanka, you know, you probably remember those times when you were very young. Whole family of 15, 20, 30 people, so many generations in the same house. No TV, no radio, no sort of iPods. They were actually in a semicircle, and there was just one small oil lamp. They would use the top of a toothpaste tube, and they put some rag through that. That was a wick. You know, incredible recycling. And they'd be telling stories to each other. Every evening, grandparents, uncles, kids, they must have heard those stories so many times. They always laughed at them. They knew the punchline. They knew it was coming, and they couldn't hold themselves. But they were together every evening of every day of the year of their lives. And when I saw that, I realized what I'd missed. Growing up, they had really, really strong family ties in those days. And it was just so beautiful to see. So, not enough young people to look after the old, not enough old people to look after the young. What are you talking about? It's only because we live in separate houses. It's because we separate, we don't have time. That's the problem. Why don't we have time? Because we need the money to buy the separate houses. My friend have a motto, you only live once. Ha ha. You don't only live once. That's absolutely stupid. One person said, you know, to live once would be such a miracle. If you can live once, why not live twice, three times? Things don't just happen by themselves, not just once. It always keeps on coming back again. You can't have one day. The sun's going to rise tomorrow. You're not going to have just one hot day this summer. Tomorrow you're going to have another hot day. Or a hot day next year. You know, the whole of life goes around in cycles. You know, the spheres revolve. Moon's going around Earth. Earth's going around solar systems. Solar systems go around the Milky Way. And the Milky Ways go around their local group of galaxies. It's always going round and round. And even universes get reincarnated. That's modern science. This is not the first Big Bang. There have been universes before. There will be universes afterwards. To think that somehow we're special, we only live once and that's all, that's the most crazy idea I've ever heard of. Old days, we never had that. The Greeks all believed in reincarnation. Pythagoras, Socrates, they were all into it. Read Plato's Republic, the last chapter all about reincarnation. And that was just Western culture, have reincarnation. The trouble is, when you have reincarnation, you lose a lot of power over people. In one life, you have much more power over them. Controlling governments would hate it if you're going to live again. It's a power trip. That's my theory anyway. So you don't only live once. There's so many people. He's not here today, but I keep on saying about him, he was regressed, you know, by one of our members here. You know, the hypnotic regression. He remembered his past life. 150 years ago, he came to Perth as a person in the British Navy. And he stayed here. He worked in the old Fremantle jail for 1 year. And then he got an agricultural grant in Plantagenet region, around Mount Barker somewhere. He built his own stone house. He lived to 78 years of age. He married, had kids. He even knows where his gravestone was. And he comes most Fridays to Dhammaloka Centre. You remember, and it all matches. It's there, it's true. And it's amazing. There's so many cases like that. And if one person gets reborn, that'd be very weird if one does and no one else does. There's so much evidence around it. People must be just so blinded by their views and unable to face the facts to think there's only one life. So if your friends have a motto, you only live once, and you say, when you come back again, I'm going to tell you I told you so. They should just enjoy life. If it's only one, this is a problem here. If you say enjoy life because it's only live once, it means you take no responsibility. You just squeeze as much as you can out of this body, out of this planet Earth. You leave nothing for anybody else. That's really selfish. That's why this is one of the reasons why we have problems with climate change, why we have problems with just looking after the economy rather than looking after people. Just why things matter more than just, you know, qualities like love and kindness and family and stuff. It's because we become far too materialistic, because we think this is our one and only life. Squeeze as much out of it as possibly can. If I don't get caught, great. That's one of the big problems in our modern world. Spiritually, I don't care whether it's Christianity or trouble with some things. You only live once and you go to heaven or hell. Come back here, for goodness sake. Face the mess which you made. I think that's really fair. And if people do that, I would say that Mr. Bush, the second Mr. Bush, he's going to get reincarnated in Iraq. Isn't that fair? And as for, you know, Mr. Abbott, he'll get reincarnated either in Christmas Island or in, more likely, in Indonesia. Anyway, I should go further with that, otherwise I get into big trouble. Okay, so any questions from the floor here? Okay, great. So let's finish off now. It's 9 o'clock, and have a great evening. And maybe see, I'll be over teaching a retreat next weekend in China Grove. So it'll be Ajahn Pamali here next week. He's really good. And Ajahn Sujata the week afterwards. So let's pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.